Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think we finally managed to pack in, I think, what it must be the fourth capacity audience this week, Alan. Yeah, the events series at the LSE is working rather well this year. Welcome to what is the 30th annual Martin White Memorial Lecture. You haven't come to hear me, but I thought I might start off by just mentioning briefly the nature of this series. Martin White was a major figure within the discourse of international relations at all sorts of levels. He was a leading Chatham House figure in the late 30s and in the 1940s. While at Chatham House, he wrote what was, from an IR theory point of view, the single most influential pamphlet Chatham House has ever published. It's called Power Politics, which actually it isn't about power politics, but it's still an incredibly influential pamphlet, later reissued. He was a reader at the London School of Economics from 1949 to 61, and I think he shaped the teaching of IR theory at the LSE and in a lot of other places ever since. He was one of the two people who created or is responsible for, delete where inapplicable, the English School. He was a major figure in this period. In 61, he moved to Sussex to become the Dean of European Studies, the founding dean there, and set up the School of European Studies. Died sadly very early in 1972, and in memory of this man who made such a great contribution to all three institutions, the three institutions instituted this lecture, which is held at every year, but it's held on a rotating basis, 1 year at the LSE, 1 year at Chatham House, 1 year at the University of Sussex. Over the last 30 years, there have been some very, very distinguished speakers, but none more distinguished than our speaker tonight, Honora O'Neill, or Baroness O'Neill of Bengal, as she became in 1999 when she was appointed to the House of Lords, where she sits on the cross benches. Honora was educated at Oxford and at Harvard, where John Rawls was her PhD supervisor, which is quite a pedigree, I think it's fair to say. She's one of the leading Kant scholars in Britain and indeed in the world. She was professor of philosophy at the University of Essex before she became principal of Newnham College, Cambridge, 1992. She's always been an applied ethicist. First time I met Honora was on Mont Saint-Michel 15 years ago at a conference on international ethics on borders and international political theory. She wrote a book in the 80s on the faces of hunger. She's written extensively on transnational justice. In recent years, she's become a major figure in the area of bioethics, the Human Genetics Advisory Council, the chairman of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. In 2002, she was the Reith Lecturer with a series on A Question of Trust. I'm very pleased that tonight she's going to talk to us on the subject of the dark side of human rights. It's my privilege to introduce Professor O'Neill.
Thank you all for coming. You are a distinguished and a daunting audience in many ways, particularly for a philosopher talking on this subject. I thought I'd begin by telling you about the first time I came to give a paper at the LSE. It wasn't down here, it was somewhere up there in logic and scientific method, and it had been Popper's department. So I thought, well, choose something rather logically rigorous and dry for this occasion. So I did something on abstraction and idealization. And I got in and I started. This was a seminar. I read a sentence. Up shot a lot of hands. Out came an objection. And I said, yes, in the next sentence, I'm going to address that point. And I had three interruptions on the first paragraph. So that you see, the idea was first the refutations and then the conjectures. Now, tonight I hope it'll be different in one respect, but not in all respects. This paper is certainly, in certain ways, conjectural. In a sense, that's my advantage in having an audience like you. It's quite short, but it is, I hope, raising some questions which I, at any rate, would like to see answered, and I don't know large swathes of the answer. I gave it what you may think a lurid title, because, as we all know, human rights are wonderful, boundless, luminous, and certainly don't have a dark side. But if we want them to be substantial, then like other bodies, there may be a dark side. So that's where I'm going to go, but I'm going to begin with some fairly well-known comments on human rights issues. So if you want that little doze, the beginning perhaps is the time for the doze. Now, we all know that human rights receive enormous lip service, but equally, because we're all intellectually rigorous, we think that doesn't mean they should have uncritical admiration. We want to know, and I think this is, you know, just completely straight, we want to know how, if at all, human rights claims might be justified. We want to know what those supposed justifications assume. And I think we want to know the corollaries of those justifications. What do they bring in their wake? What might they leave us with? And do we really want what they might leave us with? Are human rights, for example, best anchored in international law and international conventions? Or are they really to be anchored in a rather deeper way in fundamental accounts, for example, of human needs, of the good, of human agency, of obligations? I don't really choose between those. Now, those classical worries have, I think, during my lifetime, tended to recede into the background. The huge, gigantic cultural movement to promote human rights in the last 50 years has gradually become so successful that it seems to me that certain questions of this elementary sort about the justification of human rights are rather easily taken for granted. You will all of you remember a sentence which runs, "The ideas of the ruling class in every epoch are the ruling ideas." Well, if any ideas have a claim to be the ruling ideology of our age, I think it is the ideas associated with human rights. And unlike lots of earlier ideologies, the human rights movement has, it seems, acquired a very beguiling feature in that it's an ideology not only of and for the ruling classes — now that may seem to you an odd thing to say, but I think it is true — but an ideology for, as well as increasingly of, the oppressed and those who are ruled. So that seems to me actually a very good reason to try to think particularly carefully and critically about the internal structure of human rights claims, their basis, and their costs, as well as their benefits. Now let me go back to somebody whom we all read when we first begin to read about rights at all, usually when we read about natural rights or the like. Edmund Burke, in his Reflections on the Revolution in France, said this. It's not one of the better known passages, but it is germane to my purpose. "What is the use of discussing a man's abstract right to food or medicine? The question is upon the method of procuring and administering them. In that deliberation, I shall always advise to call in the aid of the farmer and the physician rather than the professor of metaphysics." Well, I think Burke's question is pretty sharp and not at all a dead question. What is the value of having a right? More specifically, what is the value of having an abstract right without a way of securing whatever it is you're supposed to have a right to? Why should we prize natural or abstract rights when there may be no way of ensuring their delivery? And if we need to secure their delivery, are not the farmer and the physician, as Burke so nicely puts it, not merely of greater use than abstract or natural rights, but also of greater use than positive rights to claim food or medicine? For a hungry person, positive and justiciable rights to food are, to be sure, better than abstract rights that are not justiciable. But somebody who knows how to grow, harvest, and store food and to cook it is rather better, and having the food and the medicine is, I suppose, better still. So I've got my mind a bit on the farmer and the physician who actually produce the food and the, as we say today, the healthcare, the medicine for short. Now, in a way, I think it's rather surprising to find Burke making comments on abstract rights to food or healthcare, for these presumed rights only came to full prominence in the late 20th century. They are commonly called welfare rights. I think that's a misnomer. They're called welfare rights and contrasted with liberty rights. And I believe it's a misnomer because the salient feature of these rights, the thing that distinguishes them, is not that they contribute to the welfare of the recipient. As a matter of fact, liberty rights probably contribute a great deal to human welfare. The salient thing is that rights to goods, they are rights to goods and services. And if there are to be rights to goods or services, those goods or services have to be provided. And they have to be provided by someone, hence the farmer and the physician. Now, most of the abstract rights against which Burke campaigned were the rights of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, what are now, and they are mostly what we call liberty rights. The short list in Article 2 of that declaration states succinctly, quote, "The natural rights of man which must not be prevented are freedom, property, security, and resistance to oppression." Okay. Needless to say, the right to property, as characterized here, is not a right to some amount of property. It's not a right to some goods. It's a right to security of tenure of property that one has, security of transfer, I suppose. So it, too, in fact, is a liberty right. Much of the Declaration is concerned with rights to process, with rights which would be needed to make liberty rights justiciable, rights to the rule of law, rights to habeas corpus, to what we'd now call accountable public administration. Now, the rights of the Declaration are all of them rights against all others, against individuals and against institutions, and the framers of the Declaration were, I think, particularly insistent that these were rights against institutions, not just against others. Now, a great advantage of keeping one's focus squarely on liberty rights is that there isn't any problem about knowing who has the counterpart obligations. Liberty rights are going to be compromised if there are any others who are not bound by the counterpart obligations. If others could legitimately infringe my supposed liberty rights, my freedom, my property, security, or were liberty to oppress me, I'd have only incomplete or blemished or restricted rights of these sorts. On closer consideration, of course, as we know, matters have turned out to be in one respect more complicated, because the institutions for securing and enforcing liberty rights do require the allocation of particular obligations to some others rather than to all others. There is no effective rule of law without law enforcement. There's no effective law enforcement without law enforcers, who are assigned particular tasks by the courts, the police, so on. And there's no effective accountable public administration without an institutional allocation of the tasks and obligations of holding to account. Nevertheless, I think that asymmetry between abstract liberty rights and supposedly abstract rights to goods and services is convincing. We could know who has violated a liberty right even in the absence of any allocation of obligations, but we could not know who had violated a right to some good or service in the absence of any allocation of obligations. Now, this well-known point, I think it's been made for 200 years recurrently by lots of people, and hasn't actually impeded the rise of the international human rights culture, which is now replete with claims about abstract rights to goods and services. But as I shall argue, nevertheless, often muddled about the allocation of obligations without which these rights could not be met, indeed would remain undefined. The cornucopia of new rights, of course, includes rights to food and medicine, only we say now rights to food and health care. The right to food can be found in very robust form in Article 11 of the 1966 International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, which recognizes, I quote, "the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living for himself and his family, including adequate food, clothing, and housing, and the continuous improvement of living conditions. End of quote. That continuous improvement is a particularly nice touch, isn't it? Where did that come from? I shall be fascinated if any of you knows the intellectual history of the continuous improvement clause, but of course one's seeing it pop up all over the place now. How could one possibly have a respectable public policy that was not committed to continuous improvement? And this has become the guiding principle, by the way, of, among other set-ups, the Food and Agricultural Organization. So if you look at the FAO website, you'll find references back to Article 11. The right to health comes along in Article 12 of the government, which recognizes, quote, the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And that's become the guiding principle of the World Health Organization. So you see these covenants then get, as it were, signed, ratified, institutionalized, adopted as guiding policies and so on. I note in passing, because I think it's rather interesting, a difference in the way these two rights are formulated in the covenant. The right to food is a right to adequate food. It's not a right to the best attainable food. The right to health is a right to the highest attainable standard of health, but it's not a right to adequate health. Now, I think one can see why the drafters of the convention may have shrunk a little bit, just been a tad shy about proclaiming a right to adequate health. But in qualifying this right as a right to the highest attainable standard of health, many questions were begged. Is this right only a right to the standard of health that a person can attain, with locally available and affordable remedies and treatment, however meager those might turn out to be in a given context? Or is it a right to the highest standard available globally, however expensive and exotic that may be? The first is, of course, disappointingly minimal, and the latter is barely coherent. Generally, whenever one sees maximalist notions appearing in claims about rights, one should be very suspicious, because a right to the best is clearly rather like a right to be the winner in some competitive situation. It can't be held by all. So uncertainties of this sort are perhaps unavoidable if rights and their counterpart obligations are not clearly specified. But of course, the unclarity might prove remediable. Well, I think that in a slightly self-critical spirit, as my home discipline being philosophy, I do wonder, does any of this matter? And now I'm going to have a bit of time exploring the thought, everything's all right and it doesn't really matter. But the thought, as you will see, comes at a considerable cost. Perhaps we should just view the declarations and conventions as documents that set out noble aspirations, aspirations which is a good idea to articulate before one gets sets about the very messy business of trying to construct institutions, programs, policies, activities, streams of funding, and so on, that might help realize the aspirations. That's one way of reading it all. In effect, this way of reading it would concede that the rhetoric of abstract rights to goods and services is deceptive, but would then claim may be deceptive, but it's a noble lie that helps to mobilize support for establishing justiciable, positive rights of very great importance. Well, I think there's actually something to be said for this cynical reading of the human rights culture that has grown across the last 50 years. In effect, we would be viewing the drafting of declarations and conventions as ideological exercises intended to mobilize energy for action that makes a difference. But I think we have to concede that that cynical reading of human rights claims would be wholly at odds with people's ordinary understanding of those claims. We normally think both of liberty rights and of rights to goods and services, a whole spectrum of human rights, as claim rights or entitlements that are good against those others, individuals, institutions, whatever, who hold the counterpart obligations. In short, we think of rights normatively. We think of them as part of a normative relationship, as prescribing certain requirements, not just pointing towards certain nice aspirations. And a corollary of this is that we normally regard supposed claims or entitlements that nobody is obliged to respect or honour as null, void, and undefined, not really claims and entitlements at all. An understanding of normative arguments that link rights and obligations is, after all, the common core of our very daily discussions, both of supposedly universal, abstract, moral, or human rights, and of special rights created by particular transactions or voluntary activity, whether we're thinking of treaties, statutes, contracts, promises, marriages, whatever. All those rights are, in the old sense of the term, special rights arising out of some special relationship between the right holder and some previous action by the obligation bearer. Now, there cannot be claim rights that are not rights against others. Universal rights will be rights against all comers, but special rights, and among them rights to goods and services, will only be rights against specifiable others, i.e. those who took part in the relevant transaction, treaty, contract, whatever it is. And I think our problem is that only if we jettison the entire understanding of rights as normative in favour of the thought that they are merely aspirational, only in that case could we break the normative link between rights and obligations, rights and their counterpart obligations. If we take rights seriously, as I see it, we have to see them as normative and not just aspirational, and then we have to take obligations seriously. If we opt for the merely aspirational view, we'd have to accept that when human rights are when they're not met, there will be no breach of obligation, because no obligation was defined, nobody who is at fault, nobody who can be held to account, and nobody who owes redress. We would, in effect, have to accept that human rights claims are not real claims. So I think there's real difficulty in going down view that human rights claims, or indeed claims about abstract rights, are normative if we don't take obligations equally seriously. Now, my suspicion is, but perhaps I'm wrong, that most advocates of human rights would be extremely reluctant to jettison the thought that they are prescriptive or normative and not merely aspirational. We want them to matter. We want them to be things that people gain by having. We want them to be something that can be claimed. And so we generally view human rights claims as setting out requirements from the standpoint of recipients who are entitled to or have a claim to some sort of action, some sort of forbearance by others. And on a standard normative or prescriptive view, their point would be lost if, having reached that stage, we say, but nobody has to do anything, nobody is required to act or forbear. A normative view, in short, is going to fall flat if there are no counterpart obligations. Now, hardly any proponent of human rights would countenance the thought that there are human rights which nobody is required or obliged to respect. It just seems to nullify the claim that they're human rights. Now, this claim that rights must have counterpart obligations is not equivalent to the commonplace piety that rights and responsibilities go together. And I mention it because it seems to be widely said, and it's quite plausible. You know, children will be told that they have rights, but they also have responsibilities. Fine, there's nothing wrong with that, but it is a completely different claim from a claim about rights and obligations, because in talking about the sort of very open thought that if you've got rights, you'll have some responsibilities. There's no claim that the responsibilities you will have will be in any way conceptually linked to the rights you have, and they certainly won't be those responsibilities the same as the obligations that make a reality of any rights you have. Because, of course, your rights would be rights against someone else and who would hold obligations. Those obligations would not be your obligations, but the obligations against which you can claim. So I just want to put that aside, because it seems to me so frequently said and actually so irrelevant to the topic. Now, on a normative view, I think rights and claimable obligations have to be seen as really two ways of looking at the same thing. You look from the perspective of the right holder, and you have a pattern of rights. You look from the perspective of obligation bearers, and you have a pattern of obligations. But in each case, rights and obligations are relational, and they are the same set of relations seen in different directions. And what I called in passing a cynical reading of human rights as mere aspirations rather than requirements, though not at all popular, is I think one we've got to hold on to for a moment, if only to remind us that there's an exit strategy available if we conclude that claiming rights without specifying counterpart obligations is an unacceptable deception, but find that we can't develop a normative account of human obligations. So I want to keep that thought, it's all just aspirational, parked nearby in case we need a hasty exit. Now, clearly it would be preferable to provide a serious account of the obligations needed to make a reality of taking seriously an account of rights, taking account of rights seriously, and taking a normative view of rights. But the question arises, who holds the counterpart obligations? That, I think, is the fundamental question. And one standard view is that the obligations that correspond to human rights are held in the first instance by states. The point is, I think, rather complicated by some pretty obscure drafting in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, which indeed gestures to the thought that the obligations lie with states, but then rather unfortunately speaks indifferently of nations, countries, and peoples as well as states. Well, not all of these are the same, as you all know, and not all of them have the sort of unitary powers to decide and to act that make them competent to be obligation bearers. You need a certain capacity to act and to decide and to carry obligations. But for present purposes, I want to leave that mess on one side. I suspect it's just poor drafting, though others may know a lot more about it, and rely on the fact that in later international documents and conventions, the ambiguities are, it seems, resolved in favour of the view that the obligations lie with states, though, as we shall see, it is a question which obligations lie with states. For example, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights ostensibly assigns the obligations that are relevant to human rights to the states party, that is, to the signatory state to the convention. Well, this approach has some rather nice advantages, but I also think it has some stings in the tail. The first seeming advantage is that if the obligations defined by the conventions arise out of voluntary transactions, that is, signing and ratifying a treaty, then they're going to be special rather than fundamental rights. One incidental implication will be that states that don't ratify a convention will not incur those special obligations, the obligations that it specifies, is another way of putting it. And that's not really a welcome conclusion, since it means that states party can legitimately escape obligations to respect the rights promulgated. All you have to do is to refrain from signing up, and ratifying. Not that this seems tremendously to inhibit states. A second, even less welcome corollary will be that if the obligations created by signing or ratifying conventions aren't fundamental, but special or institutional obligations, then the rights that are the corollaries to those obligations will also not be fundamental rights, but special or institutional rights. For once we take a normative view of rights and obligations, they're going to have to fall on the same side of the line. If human rights are prior to institutional structures, the sort of thing you could appeal to in justifying institutional structures rather than created by special transactions, so too are the corresponding obligations. Equally, if the obligations are merely the creatures of conventions, so too are the rights. I think that's a conclusion a lot of people would not really want to reach. I'm just going to open a bottle of water. So. Now, these unwelcome implications of the human rights documents could be avoided in several ways. One well-known thought is that so long as we confine ourselves to liberty rights, there's not going to be an allocation problem, because liberty rights are compromised unless everybody, and that is all agents, all individuals, all institutions, are bound by the corresponding obligations. So liberty rights and their counterpart obligations could both coherently be viewed as prior to institutions or transactions, and the parts of the conventions that deal with liberty rights could be interpreted as affirming or recognizing rather than creating those rights and obligations. It's actually quite interesting to look at all the verbs people use here. Very nice verbs where you can't really tell whether it's a matter of claiming that there is a pre-institutional right and obligation, or on the other hand, it is something that you are actually proclaiming or stipulating. But I think that conclusion, namely that it works for liberty rights, is going to be pretty small comfort to people who think that rights to goods and services, rights to food and medicine, are fundamental rights. Because a normative view of human rights can't view rights to food and medicine as pre-institutional, while denying that there are any counterpart obligations on counterpart obligation holders. A normative view of obligations to provide goods and services that accepts that their allocation is institutionally defined must accept the corollary that the corresponding rights will be institutional, not fundamental. There's, of course, nothing wrong or problematic about conventional or institutional rights. They're fine things, positive rights, if you will. But if that is what the declarations and conventions are about, then the claim that these are universal human rights and provide a way of justifying institutions look far less convincing. For it would always be possible to ask why one rather than another configuration of rights and obligations should be institutionalized. Well, could one fudge the dilemma? Well, perhaps one could allow the idea of human rights to goods and services to drift gently between the two interpretations. One view would see rights to goods and services as prior to institutions and transactions, as offering a way of justifying some rather than other institutional arrangements, and the other view would see rights to goods and services as the creatures of convention, with well-defined counterpart institutional obligations, but at the cost of finding the justification for any such arrangements elsewhere. Still, I think one has to concede that deliberate equivocation is a pretty desperate justificatory strategy, so I'm not really advocating letting our understanding of the matter drift to and fro. The dilemma within normative views of rights and obligations could, I think, be resolved in more than one way. We could conclude that liberty rights are fundamental rights, but rights and goods to goods and services are only institutional or positive rights, and perhaps none the worse for that. That would be a perfectly coherent position. We could conclude, and many have, that all rights and all obligations are institutional or positive rights. All are the creatures of conventions or custom or whatever. We could justify institutional structures that define and secure rights and their counterpart obligations by showing, perhaps, that they serve a range of human interests. I think perhaps lawyers find that quite a congenial perspective, or a range of preferences. Or we could justify institutional structures that define and secure institutional rights and obligations in terms of a theory of the good. A lot of moral realists, or a very soft subjective theory of the good, consequentialists of other sorts, or even a theory of duty, Kantians. The option that's not open is to see rights and obligations as corollary normative claims, while maintaining that there are fundamental rights that have no counterpart fundamental obligations. So there are plenty of possibilities, although, of course, each is going to raise its own difficulties. If none of these possibilities could be made to work, the default position would, I think, be to reject normative views of human rights and to see the human rights documents as aspirational, and then to see the task of establishing standards and norms and institutions as a further matter that can be, to some extent, guided by these aspirations. And then, in a way, we're back with what I briefly labelled the cynical view of the matter. Now, these are very awkward problems, but I think other problems might be even deeper. For when we look closely at the declarations and conventions, I believe a more fundamental difficulty emerges. And I'm going to approach it by going back to the question of why the conventions and declarations assign obligations to states. Now, one reason that they do so is presumably the thought that states, unlike other institutions, unlike individuals, have the necessary powers to carry the obligations. Assigning obligations to agents without capacities to carry them out is, after all, pointless. If ought implies can, you don't put the obligations with those who can't. There's a story told about that the journalist asked the bank robber, Willie Sutton, why he robbed banks. And he replied, well, that's where the money is. You can almost hear that he might have said, that's where the money is, stupid. And similarly, we might reply to someone who asks why the obligations that seemingly correspond to human rights should be assigned to states by pointing out that that's where the power is. But I think the thought that it makes sense to assign obligations that are somehow relevant to rights to states, simply because they have the power to discharge some of them, perhaps not all of them, is often less than comforting. Many states are violators rather than respecters of rights, and assigning obligations that supposedly correspond to human rights to states may be rather like putting foxes in charge of hen houses. It's true enough that those who discharge human rights must have capacities to discharge them, but it doesn't in the least follow that all institutions with the capacity to discharge them can be trusted to discharge them, or to ensure that they are discharged. Some states, we sometimes call them rogue states, are major violators of rights and don't go very far to secure rights for their inhabitants, one dare hardly say citizens. And nevertheless, those states are often quite happy to sign and ratify the relevant conventions. Moreover, many states, in fact, lack the power to carry the obligations that the declarations and conventions assign them. Weak states, failed states, quasi-states are pretty ill placed to carry these very complex obligations. Although they may not violate, they also may not be able to secure their inhabitants' liberties rights, and in fact, they're highly likely to violate them. Still less are they able to secure their inhabitants' rights to goods and services. So perhaps it's just an empty gesture to assign obligations needed for human rights to weak states, let alone to the international community, rather like the empty gesture made by certain town councils in Britain in the 1980s when they proclaimed that they were nuclear-free zones. It was a very nice gesture, but that's what it was. So perhaps we should reopen the question whether all obligations needed for human rights should lie with states. The assumption that states and states alone should hold the relevant obligations might, after all, reflect the extraordinary extent of state power in the mid-20th century and not a timeless solution to the problem of allocating obligations to provide goods and services. But I still don't think this reaches to the deepest problem. And the deepest problem, and here I'm going to be sketchier than I would like to be, and perhaps will be after you've helped me think it through a bit more, seems to be that the obligations assigned to states by the declarations and conventions aren't, when you look at the matter carefully, obligations to respect the rights that are declared in those documents. They are rather obligations to secure that others respect them. They are not assigned obligations to meet rights to goods and services, but obligations to ensure that rights to goods and services are met. And this is so basic that we almost read past it and think that it's the counterpart obligations being assigned to states. Now, just to remind you of how this goes, in the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, we read, each state party to the present covenant undertakes to take steps individually and through international assistance and cooperation, especially economic and technical, to the maximum of available resources, with a view to achieving progressively the full realization of the rights recognized in the present covenant by all appropriate means, including particularly the adoption of legislative measures. I think that gives you a sort of feel for how indirect the obligations laid on states are, or how systemic, I'm not quite sure how we should characterize them. Now, achieving progressively the full realization of rights by all appropriate means is evidently not merely a matter of respecting the rights recognized in the convention. It's a matter of ensuring that many individuals and many institutions carry out very complex obligations that are, if all goes well, going somehow to secure that, in effect and in total, the proclaimed rights are secured. Now, an immediate and encouraging thought, at least it seemed to me encouraging when I first thought of it, is that if the obligations assigned aren't really the counterparts of the human rights proclaimed, then this removes or dilutes the allocation problem. States party to a convention are seen as having obligations, but not rights, let alone human rights. That's all right, you can have obligations without rights. The problem all along has been you can't have rights without obligations if you take a normative view. Now, this first thought is rather helpful. Obligations without counterpart rights are going to be normatively coherent, so we can take a normative view of the obligations conferred by the conventions on states. And human rights come in only as a way of specifying certain aspects of the content of state obligations or certain aspects of the outcome of the realization of state obligations. But a second thought is very unhelpful. If the obligations conferred by the declarations and conventions aren't the counterparts of human rights that are declared or recognized, then those human rights simply lack counterpart obligations. So the problem of giving a coherent normative reading of the declarations and conventions can't be resolved this way. If the claims of the human rights documents are to have normative force, they have to be matched by obligations, and if they're not matched by obligations, they are at most aspirational. Now, as I suggested earlier, it may not be wholly a misfortune if we're driven back to think that the supposed rights declared in the declarations and conventions are aspirations. I think that perhaps quite a lot of lawyers would be willing to say that there's still substance in there, in that the states party take on real obligations to realize these aspirations up to a point. Those of us who are not lawyers may make the mistake, foolish us, of thinking that the declarations and conventions claim that they're pre-institutional human rights. But this mistake is one we don't have to make, although it may be politically very convenient, and for progress towards the realization of the underlying aspirations, it's unnecessary to think that human rights are really legitimate claims. I think this is a coherent position. As I've said, I know it would be very unpopular, and it's worth spelling out the reasons that make it unpopular. It would be unpopular because advocates of human rights like to base ethical and political arguments on appeals to human rights. They like to use them as justificatory arguments. They want to see them as normatively fundamental and not just as creatures of a convention, that is, of conventions whose real task is to assign obligations to realize aspirations. However, this reading of the declarations and conventions that tries to turn the rights into normative claims has, I think, some very heavy cultural costs. If the human rights movement is grounded not in pre-conventional, that is, abstract, fundamental, moral, natural, human rights of human beings, but in the obligations assumed by states, there's a very awkward gap between reality and rhetoric. For the reality is then that state agency and state power and the agency and power of other derivative institutions that are required to secure these various so-called rights and to control the action of individual human agents are the centerpiece. Individual human beings appear in the human rights enterprise as the beneficiaries of the process and as bearing the burdens of the process, but not, except for those who are taking part in the institutions, as agents of the process. I think that's a very heavy cost. I'm now going very briefly to list four problems that seem to me to arise as costs here. And it was pure accident that the words are rather similar. I think the first problem, and a very obvious one, is complexity. Legislation in the age of human rights has become prolix and burdensome. Those who frame it have a problem. They're trying to find a way of simultaneously securing a very wide range of distinct objectives, so they have to make very intricate requirements. Enormous complexity is built into legislation and regulation. It is studied with complaints procedures, appeals procedures, duties to consult, requirements to follow specific processes. The extraordinary, relentless quality of guidance in a political culture that's trying to do this is quite remarkable. Sometime in the small hours this morning, having left the radio on, I heard, I think it was probably a minister, explaining that we needn't worry about something, I now know not what, because they had just issued 200 pages of guidance. Well, 200 pages of guidance for people down here in the institutions, universities, schools, whatever it may be, is a nightmare. But it is a nightmare that is perpetrated continually with legislation that is trying constantly at every juncture to meet too many potentially conflicting standards, so has to build in caveats of this complexity. The second problem is that of compliance. The role for individuals who are subject to this legislation is, after all, mainly that they're meant to comply with it. Human rights are, as it were, presented to us as liberating, but the experience for many people is that they are burdening. They are burdening because to respect rights of this complexity and detail is very burdensome. Then there is the question of complaints. One of the ways in which constant attempts are made to achieve compliance with all human rights standards is to build in complaints procedures. You will find them all through current legislative, regulatory, and institutional practices, and of course you will find them built in to the requirements on all other institutions. As you probably know, one of the new regulators for the universities this year is the Office of the Independent Adjudicator, to ensure that we have a centralized system for checking all the complaints procedures that each university has in case the complaints procedures at different universities had different structures or didn't meet the appropriate standards. Now, individuals are certainly frustrated by hyper-complex demands of this sort. Finally, I think there is the question of compensation. We hear a great deal on the edge of life about the problem of the compensation culture, and I think it's a big problem. And in a sense, it's the only upside if the institutions you live with force a passive role upon you, well, either nothing goes wrong, and that's quite nice, or if something goes wrong, suddenly there are the mechanisms for not just for complaining, but for seeking compensation and the dubious pleasures of blaming. And, of course, blame now can reach not merely the person who wronged you, but above all, the institution that failed to prevent them from wronging you. And I think we can see this tendency in many, many walks of life. Now, I'm going to finish, simply because I like it very much, with a small passage from Nietzsche. Nietzsche wrote quite a lot on blame and passivity and rancor, on what it's like to find yourself in the passive position. And here is something that he said. It is a passage about the insidious effects of blaming, even when you might have reason to blame. And he depicts the pleasures of blaming as peculiarly tempting to us when we're put in a position of weakness. It's a way in which one can, as it were, engage with the status of victim. One can enjoy and prolong that role, even perhaps when others' faults are not demonstrable, because they don't have to be demonstrable. The fact that something went wrong is in itself going to be sufficient evidence that somebody failed to prevent it going wrong. He writes, "Someone or other must be to blame that I feel ill. This kind of conclusion is peculiar to all sick people, and in fact becomes more insistent the more they remain in ignorance of the true reasons. The sufferers, one and all, are frighteningly willing and inventive in their pretexts for painful emotions. They even enjoy being mistrustful and dwelling on wrongs and imagined slights. They rummage through the bowels of their past and present for obscure, questionable stories, which will allow them to wallow in tortured suspicion and intoxicate themselves with their own poisonous wickedness. They rip open the oldest wounds, and they make themselves bleed to death from scars long since healed. They make evildoers out of friend, wife, child, and anyone else near them." Now, I do not want to suggest that the human rights culture has to lead, or lead only, to a rancorous view of the world. But I do not think we should accept it at face value as being entirely luminous and on the side of the good and all about respect for persons and treating others as agents. I think the dark side of human rights is that it casts human beings, human individuals like each of us, into a passive role, and our duties are reduced to compliance and our opportunities to complaint. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We have around a quarter of an hour for questions. Perhaps we take 30 seconds for those who have to leave to leave. Just to No, let's not do that. Let's have questions. Adam, Sir Adam Ross. We should have a microphone somewhere. There.
I hate to sound optimistic, which is against the spirit of the trade of those of us in the field of international relations who are here, but I think there is a bright side to the dark side that you have discussed. And the bright side is this, that aspirational statements about the quasi-duties of government to ensure human rights, and many of them do end up being somewhat aspirational, have an effect in that they legitimize political movements that seek to have something real made of those rights. And in some cases, the Helsinki Final Act is perhaps the clearest example. The obligations in respect of human rights, and indeed the whole Helsinki Final Act, were not made formally legally binding documents. It was openly accepted that they were aspirational, but they then provided a basis for political movements in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union itself to demand that some reality be made of these aspirational claims. And I don't think it's wholly accidental that, Charter 77 was formed on the day when the international covenants, the two that you were discussing, civil and political rights and social and cultural rights, came into force in the law of the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic. So something can be made by political movements, and there are cases in the West as well, in the United States over Haiti, when the Congressional Black Caucus was outraged by the treatment of Haitian refugees and demanded better treatment for them on the basis of human rights. Something can be made of this ambiguity that you rightly described through the agency of political movements.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Adam. I mean, I agree with that, and I suppose that it seems to me that the real effects of aspirations is in some way a more coherent and realistic way of talking about it than the way of talking about it that construes it as a set of normative relations with the disjunctions I was talking about. And I suppose one of the questions one has to ask oneself is how important is the sleight of hand? Because the sleight of hand seems to be a matter of saying, you have a right. By the way, nobody I know of has an obligation to provide it, but we tell people you have a right to such and such. Proleptically, if you will, because one day they might have an institutionalized right. And maybe, as it were, it's worth accepting the slightly faked surface of the human rights movement because it has this rhetorical and in some cases political power. In pointing at the dark side, you'll notice my examples were taken very much from developed societies with strong liberal democracies, with highly complex institutional traditions, where I suspect fanatical worry about observing all rights at all junctures in all institutions at all times is having some very bad effects. And, you know, when it is said that, oh no, children cannot be taken to the park by their school teachers because there's a duty of care and they might hit one another with a conker, that is when I think it's gone completely mad.
Connor Geertie, Center for the Study of Human Rights. But the first, I want to make two brief points. I want to speak briefly as the chair of a discipline committee in a school. And we've had loads of appeals. We've had the ombudsman every year. We've had all the complaints you describe. And it has been absolutely wonderful. It has disciplined the school's procedures. It has given me the power to go to the head teacher and impose, with the backing of the complaining parents, a process that works much more fairly and well. We had 75 appeals this year and 3 ombudsman appeals, and they've made a huge difference. And so I'm in favour of people who are able to complain against me because it has a procedural impact. The second, briefly, I wonder about this connection between litigation culture and human rights. Now, you end the talk with the reference to the litigation and the complaints and so on. And the talk is called The Dark Side of Human Rights. So the connection seems to be being made, as it was by one of our political parties over the summer. It seems to me you therefore need to be able to show, if I may say so, that in the British context of the Human Rights Act has facilitated this culture of complaint and has actually produced outcomes as opposed to speculative legal actions which have failed, which have facilitated it. Now, I think many of the judges would say that hasn't happened.
Yes. I think I would find that quite hard to do as a non-lawyer. What I'm watching is the legislation rather than the cases. Up to a point, I'm with you on complaints procedures, though I'm appalled to think that you could need so many in 1 year. And I wonder how you would feel if it went on like that year after year.
Well, I'm trying to get a new president.
The... good complaints procedures ought, in a sense, to be self-limiting, and they ought to be self-limiting partly because they ought to be there as a sort of backstop when more informal modes of resolution don't work. And I would suspect that it's a little surprising to have 75. But the first thing when somebody tells you that they want to make a complaint is to say, okay, before I file the letter, do you want to tell me about it? Because if you file a letter, I have to show it to the person you're complaining about. A very large number of people enter complaints procedures initially on the assumption that somehow I can complain about so-and-so, who's not, however, going to know that I'm doing it. It's an educational process in a way, and one can see it quite positively that it's going after a time to lead people to realize that you reach for your negotiating hat before your litigation hat. And I take it that you're at some particular cusp in this matter. Yeah. But the bigger question is the second one, isn't it? Are we really moving in this direction? I think we are. I think that it comes very naturally to some of our political parties, but some of our civil servants, people who are drafting things, people who are taking part in consultation, to think that epicycles that might secure an additional process at each point are always beneficial.
Yeah.
Where's the mic gone? Is it?
It's all right. It's gone wrong.
Right. I think a further dark side of human rights when they're relating to the rights to goods and services is that it would seem that they would necessarily conflict with the liberty rights. Could you perhaps say something about what you see the relationship between them being, and also perhaps what you think the soundest philosophical justification for liberty rights is? Thank you.
Just... yes. yes, but not very much in two sentences. My own take is that you can say quite a lot about the structure of rights by trying to think through the implications of assigning a common status to all agents, whereby you're going to have the same rights for each, and you immediately discover that a great deal falls away and that certain liberty rights may sort of pop out and classically have from that line of justification fairly fast. I acknowledge there are many people who will say, no, you can't get any serious justification from rights without a theory of the good and the whole heavy trek through moral realism and the metaphysics of the good that go with that. I'm hoping one can do with fewer premises. The question about whether, having got the liberty rights in place, you then don't have, as it were, any space left for any rights to goods and services because that's going to violate some liberty right, is of course a very well-known problem these last 40 years. The libertarians have always held that once you have liberty rights, there's no room for everything else, anything else. And that may push people to think that the other rights, the rights to goods and services, have to be positive and institutional rights, which is a possible solution. The other way, perhaps, in which you can go, but I think one has to get much more focused on what are the core issues about liberty, is to see that liberty is not worth very much if one's starving, so that even for liberty, certain minimal, what are sometimes called basic needs, must be met. So there are a number of basic needs approaches which try to get a core of liberty rights plus a core of rights to goods and services, but this is political philosophy for the last 40 years.
Time for one more.
Yes, up there. Do you see any necessary contradiction or conflict between human rights and indigenous rights, where the latter privileges indigeneity in a way that secures, say, land rights for indigenous peoples over and above the claims of non-indigenous people? Mm-hmm. Or would you say that indigenous rights can serve as a kind of mechanism for promoting human rights?
I think the first thing to say is that human rights are going to have to be fundamentally for everybody, be one indigenous or be one non-indigenous. But if one looks at what has discussions in Canada or New Zealand or Australia, there are particular issues about certain territories and certain populations who seek, as a matter of self-determination, to have a different culture, and in Nunavut in northern Canada, or who make very specific compensation claims. Now, this is a quite separate point about compensation, but compensation is, I think, has to be tied down fairly carefully to being able to know who the wrongdoer was. And that works quite nicely if somebody drives their car across your garden and leaves some nasty ruts. You can see in principle who owes whom compensation. It gets very difficult when the harms are not done by identifiable individuals, wrongs are not done by identifiable individuals, let alone when there are multiple generations separating. And I think a lot of things which people might have perhaps better argued as rights of different sorts have been pushed under the heading of compensatory claims, but that's a big topic. In some cases, indigenous rights, or what are called indigenous rights, may be something that is over and above because a group are held to be owed some compensation. In some cases, it may be because there is a degree of separation, and as a matter of self-determination, something different can be achieved. In other cases, it's very hard to see how, for example, each of us living in the city of London and being, as it were, indigenous somewhere should have any differentiation. So I think cultural and compensation are my two headings there.
Thanks very much. I think we've all come away with this with a great deal of food for thought, or certainly I have, and I'd like to express our thanks to Honora Neal for a really very stimulating lecture. Thank you.